From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And the U.S. now has the highest coronavirus death toll in the world, more than 22,000 deaths. And around the globe, the pandemic has claimed more than 114,000 lives.
And Robin, I woke up to the sad news yesterday that a college friend's mom, 73 years old, had died after weeks in the hospital battling coronavirus. He said he wasn't able to hold her hand in the last moment of her life as she was in the first moment of his. It's just heartbreaking to think that each one of those 114,000 lives you just mentioned is a real person with loved ones who are devastated by their loss.
Yes, most insidious thing I think about this disease, they can't be with loved ones when they do lose them. Just so sorry.
Right, right, right. Mm-hmm. Makes the presence of the nurses and doctors all the more important
That's
in these
right.
moments. Well, New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo says the nation's worst hit state is starting to see a flattening of the curve and that all the numbers are on a downward slope. But there is also word today of an increase in cases in China and Singapore, two countries that appeared to be moving in the right direction. Let's get the big picture now from Jason Beaubien, NPR Global Health and Development Correspondent. Jason, first of all, where are things getting better and why?
You know, so obviously, when you do look at the big picture on this pandemic right now, so much of the focus is on the U.S. And, you know, we've got more than 500,000 cases. And there is some good news coming out of the U.S. You know, nationwide, we're seeing a slowing of the growth rate, even in the hardest hit states. You're getting a flattening out of this curve on new cases. You know, we're going at the very top of that curve and starting to bend down. You know, New York had roughly 10,000 new cases a day, so we're still at a very high level. But we are not seeing that danger of an explosive outbreak in the U.S. like we were in danger of several weeks ago. So it does seem like this plateauing is a benefit of all the social distancing, the lockdown. So, if you're looking at where are things going well, definitely there is good news in terms of what's happening at the U.S. Things are still at an incredibly high level. We haven't, you know, managed to get all the way over that hump, but that's definitely good news. The other place where you're really seeing some good news is Europe. But again, it's sort of similar. It's ahead of us, Italy, Spain, France. They're seeing the number of new daily cases going down. Again, they're still at a fairly high level. You know, Italy is about 500 a day, but we are seeing some of this starting to come down.
What about places where things are still getting worse, and why is that happening where that's happening?
So you might be seeing headlines that cases are coming back in China, the problems in Singapore. So let's talk about those two right at the moment. China today announced 108 newly diagnosed cases. Of those, 98, so almost all of them, were imported cases. These are people who are traveling, Chinese nationals who'd come back. Most of that transmission is coming from Europe. There were only 10 local cases, and 7 of those were up at Heilongjiang. It's in the province in the very northeast of the country, up against the border with Russia. No new cases at all detected in Hubei. There's some skepticism about some of the numbers coming out of China, but these are the same reporting systems that they've been using throughout. So it's a reasonable way to gauge what's happening there. And it does appear that they're keeping local transmission incredibly low in China. Singapore, on the other hand, you know, looked like it was doing fabulously. Last week, they finally went to a really tight lockdown. They finally closed their schools. They only have about 2,500 cases total there, but 1,000 of them were detected last week. These are not imported cases. They've had some outbreaks in some dormitories. So that's kind of surprising to see given how aggressive things were going there. And then Brazil is the other hotspot that a lot of people are keeping an eye on. They've up to 22,000 cases. The death toll doubled last week. So there's definitely a lot of places where there's still things moving in the wrong direction.
You know, Jason, in the process of looking at where things are going well and where they aren't, we're learning more about the coronavirus. And one big question has been, will there be a drop off in cases when it gets warmer, as is the case with the seasonal flu? What do we know about that at this point?
So this is one of the big questions that's out there. If you look at where all of the worst outbreaks have been, Wuhan, Italy, New York City, these are in the Northern Hemisphere. They're in place. These happened during the cold months. It does appear with other respiratory diseases, influenza viruses, they spread much more easily in that cold environment. It's actually got to do with the humidity of the air is a lot less in the colder months, and the virus can move through the air more easily during that time. The question is that going to be the case with the coronavirus? And some people think yes, some people think no, but definitely we are already seeing transmission in hot, warm places. So this first year of having the coronavirus out and about, when so many people are completely naive, as they say, to it, don't have any immunity to it, scientists are saying that that will sort of trump the effect that you might have gotten with the seasonality. So even this first year, banking on, oh, we'll be fine once things start to get warm, scientists are saying don't count on it.
That is NPR Global Health and Development correspondent Jason Beaubien. And Jason, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, in France, where COVID-19 has killed more than 14,000 people, a lockdown was set to end this Wednesday, but President Emmanuel Macron is expected to extend it when he speaks to the country later today. The BBC's Hugh Schofield joins us from France by Skype. So, Hugh, Spain is easing some of its restrictions, even though the outbreak is still going strong there. What's the thinking about President Macron extending France's lockdown?
Well, I mean, we're not exactly at the same position as the Spanish are here in France, but I guess they're arguing there that they're further advanced in the sort of wave. Here in France, all I can say is that it's universally expected that Macron will say that we're not ready to lift the lockdown here at all. And we've had 4 weeks of it now, and it's more than likely it'll go through to the mid-May. Yeah. Seems to be the betting, and even then he's certainly not to commit himself now, I think, to an actual date on which it will be lifted.
Well, we heard early on that people in France were sort of mocking the Italians for how seriously the Italians were abiding by their government's restrictions, whereas in France it was harder to get them out of the cafes and off the streets. What's the attitude now? I mean, are people feeling, you know what? Yeah, we're watching what happened in Italy, what happened in Spain. We need to extend the lockdown. How are people in the street feeling?
I think that moment is long, long past. No one has been in the slightest doubt here that this is extremely serious stuff. Though, you know, the casualty rate is not as high here as it is in Italy, it's still pretty ferocious. And there is a slight bit of good news, which is that it's plateauing out. That is only because the lockdown is working. Right. So it's not a reason to stop it.
Right. Well, we've seen second waves start also in Asian countries. So I guess the concern in France is the same as the one being discussed here in the U.S., how to balance getting people back to work and, you know, boosting the economy a little with stopping the virus. So what has been the economic effect in France? I'm assuming bad.
Well, terrible. I mean, France is the first country to go into recession in Europe because of the crisis. I mean, a third of production just stopped. And then there's all the commitments that the government has made to bail out individuals, bail out companies, insure loans to come. I mean, it's going to cost absolutely billions and billions of euros. There's no question about that. There is pressure building on the government to outline some kind of prospect of going back to work properly. But as you say, the risk of a second wave is always there.
The BBC's Hugh Schofield there in France. Hugh, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, now to Mississippi, where at least 11 people are dead after tornadoes tore up that state Sunday. 72,000 people are without power. Several hundred homes are destroyed or damaged as the state is under a stay-at-home order. With its biggest uptick in COVID-19-related deaths last Friday, about 100 lives lost so far. And now this heartbreaking, truly unfair weekend. Alexandra Watts of Mississippi Public Broadcasting is here. Alexandra, what kind of damage did the tornadoes do?
The first damage really happened in the day yesterday on Sunday, and that was mainly the southeastern portion of the state. So that's where you saw some of the first fatalities. You saw damage to homes in the area. A lot of that impacted some of the areas of the Mississippi Delta. And usually the weather here, like in the state, is really bad this time of year. We had the flooding last year, and now we have this. But then you just add the pandemic on top of it. So like the usual methods of dealing with all of this, you can't do.
Right. And 11 deaths so far, people discovering bodies. Did they live in one particular area, one particular kind of home, like a mobile home? What do we know, if anything?
So mobile homes were some of the ones that were probably damaged a little bit more. The first wave of reported damages and fatalities were in one area of the state. But as the information comes out today with the damage report, it really was something that was statewide.
Of course, you're reminding us people who've lost their homes because of this tornado can't just go bunk with family because you have a stay at home and social distancing. And so they're probably forced to go to shelters where they're also going to have to stay apart from people. What a hardship.
Yes, yes. They are still wanting people to social distance while in these shelters, too. With COVID-19 and the pandemic, of course, this is so new. So how that really plays out and if that impacts space available or anything like that, I think that's just to be determined.
Wow. Alexandra Watts at member station Mississippi Public Broadcasting, thank you so much, and best of luck to you there in Mississippi.
Oh, thank you so much, Robin. Thank you for having me.
Oh, tornadoes and a pandemic. So how are you holding up? Let us know. HereAndNow.org.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Let's get some reaction now to the Trump administration's response to the coronavirus pandemic. Joining us is Leon Panetta, who was Secretary of Defense and CIA Director under President Obama and Chief of Staff at the White House under President Clinton. Secretary Panetta, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
Well, the administration has been criticized for responding too slowly to the pandemic and downplaying early warnings about how bad it could get. There is still no plan for coordinating aid to states, which are now competing with one another for medical supplies. There are multiple task forces set up to deal with the situation. What grade would you give the Trump administration for its response to this pandemic?
Oh, it's definitely a mixed record at this point. They're operating somewhere around D+, and we just don't know where it's going to end up. Obviously, the history of this pandemic, when it's written, will reflect a great deal on the mistakes that were made, the failure to pay attention to the warnings, the false hopes that were raised, the lack of preparation in terms of health supplies. It will also reflect on the leadership that stood up, a lot of governors who stood up, mayors, leaders in the healthcare area who stood up, and obviously even some of the federal agencies that have been helpful to try to deal with this crisis. But I think the question is, what's the last chapter here? And that no one really knows the answer to, because at this stage, there still lacks a great deal of testing. There still lacks a great deal of tracking of this disease. The treatment still is very much up in the air in terms of a vaccine. So I think the last chapter, hopefully the last chapter of this pandemic, will tell us a lot about what history will write about how this was handled.
Well, there are a lot of questions about whether that last chapter will include Dr. Anthony Fauci, one of the leading health experts on the president's task force. Last night, President Trump retweeted someone who used the hashtag #FireFauci. Fauci said this weekend that an earlier response by the administration could have saved lives. Do you think that President Trump is going to fire Fauci, and what would happen if he does?
Well, you know, you have to look at the record of how this president has dealt with people that he didn't particularly like in terms of their views. And since there continue to be disagreements, it probably is impacting on the relationship. And as we've seen in the past, if the president doesn't have somebody who agrees with everything he says, It's only a matter of time before that relationship deteriorates and that person is gone.
If you were chief of staff right now, what would you do about these daily briefings that the president has been holding for weeks now? The comments often include false statements, contradictory statements about the availability of testing and potential treatments. The president has veered into campaign rally territory with attacks on the media and other things. Do you think that those briefings are helpful to the public? Would you continue them?
I think that the briefings have not been very helpful in terms of really focusing on the information, the facts that are out there, and presenting those facts to the American people. The healthcare officials that are part of the team obviously do a very good job in terms of presenting the facts as they know it, and you have a sense of trusting what they say. On the other hand, when the president gets up there, it wanders a great deal. Frankly, those briefings last too long. They go on and on and on, and I think the public feels that it can't always trust the information that it's getting. So for that reason, I would keep those briefings a lot tighter, and I would focus specifically on the healthcare officials to present the facts to the American people. That's what should be happening.
Focus specifically on the healthcare officials. What about the economic side, though? Because President Trump has now set this May 1st as a possible date for reopening the economy, and he doesn't want the cure to be worse than the disease, meaning he doesn't want the economy to get so bad that, I mean, people will die if the economy gets as bad as some believe that it will. How do you balance that, the economic effects of the shutdown continuing and the health effects?
Well, that is, as the president himself has said, probably the most critical decision that this president is going to make, and it will in many ways determine whether or not this is going to be a success or a failure. There is no question that you're not going to get the economy started without dealing with the healthcare impact. The economy in many ways depends on the ability to control the health consequences of the coronavirus. And therefore, I think it's going to be absolutely critical for health officials to be able to say whether or not there is a point at which elements of the economy can be restarted. But it's going to depend, I think, more than anything, on what I would call the three T's. One, testing. There just has to be a lot more testing going on that determines what the baseline is with regards to the situation in the coronavirus. Secondly, tracking. We've got to be able to track people, those that have the antibodies, those who had the disease, those who don't have the disease. We've got to be able to track people in order to be able to know just exactly whether or not people can come together, whether they can go back to work. And lastly, treatment. I mean, obviously the ultimate answer is some kind of vaccine, but that's almost 18 months away. So there are a lot of questions that remain here to determine whether or not we are going to effectively implement the healthcare steps that need to be taken in order to assure that the economy can, in fact, ultimately get back to halfway normal.
The Navy now says that a sailor from the USS Theodore Roosevelt died of COVID-19. That was the aircraft carrier that was the site of the military's biggest coronavirus outbreak so far. The ship's captain, Brett Crozier, raised alarms about the situation on board in a memo last month, to which the acting Navy secretary responded by relieving Crozier of his duty. That acting secretary has since resigned. What does it tell you that the captain of this ship felt the need to publicize the situation on board instead of going through the chain of command as the president would have liked him to do?
I don't think there's any question that this was badly handled by the Navy, by the Department of Defense. It was irresponsible in the way it was handled, and frankly undermines discipline, military discipline, is critical to our ability to be ready, to be prepared in order to face any conflict abroad. But that discipline, military discipline, depends on following the rules. You've got to follow rules, and you've got to be able to implement those rules and not just do it by the seat of your pants. So there are rules for dealing with situations like this that require an investigation, that require a full study before action is taken. That wasn't done here. Secondly, judgment has to be based on the facts. It can't be based on fears. And too much of what happened here was based on a Secretary of the Navy, an acting Secretary of the Navy, who was worried more about what the president would do on the issue than on what the facts of that situation call for. And lastly, you've got to rely on the military leaders. You've got to rely on military people to tell you what needs to be done. And the military leaders here were saying, you know, let's investigate this thing before getting rid of the captain, because there are some legitimate reasons why this captain did what he did to try to protect his forces. And that's something that now, you know, I think the Navy and the military in general are going to have to do an awful lot of work to make sure that they restore military discipline.
I want to ask you one more thing, just briefly, as former defense secretary. The threats that the U.S. faced before coronavirus are not gone. What would be the number one concern you'd have right now about some foreign country, maybe Russia, maybe China, trying to take advantage of this situation while the U.S. is consumed by this virus?
Well, I would worry about something. I mean, the president keeps talking about having been able to restore ammunition and readiness in the military. I think the biggest problem today is the issue of readiness for our military. The real question is going to be whether or not an enemy out there, and we have lots of enemies, we're dealing with lots of crises from the Middle East to terrorism, to Iran, to North Korea, to Russia, to China. Those adversaries are going to be watching whether or not our readiness has been impacted and whether or not they can take advantage of that lack of readiness. We are in a very vulnerable stage, not only in terms of the healthcare issues this country's facing, the economic issues this country's facing, but I think also whether or not our military readiness is being held tight in order to be able to confront any potential adversaries.
That is Leon Panetta, the former defense secretary under President Obama, also former chief of staff under President Clinton. Secretary Panetta, thank you so much again for joining us.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
Native Americans make up about a quarter of the COVID-19 infections in New Mexico. The CDC says Native people are more vulnerable to the disease because they have higher rates of pre-existing conditions like diabetes and heart disease. Here in Now's Peter O'Dowd spoke with a farmer on the Zuni Reservation who is finding comfort in the lessons of his ancestors during this time of fear and uncertainty.
While most Americans are cooped up at home in a city, Jim Enote is on his farm in western New Mexico, where the high desert nights are dry and cold, and distance has a different meaning.
It is a land of large mesas and plateaus interspersed with deep, deep red sandstone canyons.
The Zuni people have farmed this land for thousands of years.
When I was still in a cradle board, my grandparents put seeds in my hand and held me over a hole at our family's field, and I dropped seeds into that hole. And so it's since been then that I have planted every year. So this will be now 63 consecutive years of planting.
Each spring, Enote plants chilies and onions.
Different squashes.
Many kinds of beans and corn.
And in this time of isolating ourselves, it's easy to be away from the big cities, like buses or trains. But being in a rural place is a blessing. It can be a curse, however, because adequate health care is quite some distance away.
and that could be catastrophic. According to the CDC, the death rate for Native Americans was 4 times greater than other groups during the 2009 H1N1 pandemic. And many Native people live in communities where there's no running water for basic precautions like washing hands.
And I'm worried for all of them.
Worried, but also comforted.
My great-grandparents passed away when I was 17 years old, and I learned a lot from them. They grew up in a deep way where they were really unencumbered with the kind of knowledges that we have now. And so there's things that they learned as being deep Zuni, and they passed to me, and I remember they told me things that helped to set me at ease that now are part of helping me to be able to cope better with this outbreak. I just had the blessing of having learned from people that lived a long time ago and have lived also through the big pandemic in 1918 and also lived through smallpox and measles, and they survived.
And in fact, you've written that, and this is your words, in times of great difficulty and worry, remember this truth. We are never alone. All the creatures of the universe are not much different than us. How does that bring you comfort?
Well, they would always, in times when I was having some very big difficulties, I think they would build on trust. They asked me if I trusted them, and I said yes. And then they would go on and tell me things like, birds have 2 eyes, do you agree? And I said yes. Other creatures have arms and legs to move around, and I said yes, that's true. And they would go on and just give me this things about they were, I guess it was like affirming one thing after another. Do I believe this is true? And I would say yes, and yes, and yes. And that we, there are creatures out there, and they're not much different than us. If we think about them, they would say, don't worry, because we're not alone. We are not alone, and that we're part of a collective magnificence.
A magnificence that a virus cannot destroy. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
You might have heard the report on Morning Edition today about resistance in Idaho to restrictions to stave off COVID-19. Here's Republican State Legislator Heather Scott.
Quite frankly, I don't know why Idaho is falling in line with some of the most liberal governors across this nation.
But among Idahoans taking the outbreak seriously, Jessica Schneider, a nurse in Boise, 2 weeks ago she heard New York Governor Andrew Cuomo issue this call.
As governor of New York, I am asking healthcare professionals across the country, if you don't have a healthcare crisis in your community, please come help us in New York now.
So Jessica loaded up her car and drove east, leaving behind a largely white rural state, moving into a Marriott in New York that's free for healthcare workers, and working at the public New York City Health and Hospitals Harlem site in the heart of one of New York's biggest black neighborhoods. She joins us on a break. And Jessica, first, what was it about Cuomo's call that got you into your car?
I think there's something about nurses. We are here to help people. We're people who care. We want to help. We want to be there. Even when we're tired and hungry and need to pee, people need to understand, nurses on any given day, we might pee one time. We might not eat for 12 and a half hours. We're on our feet. It's really hard for our significant others and our children and families to understand.
Well, thank you for putting it so bluntly, because it is true. It is not healthy to not, visit the ladies' room. I mean, this is the real deal. And so here you are in New York City and in an inner city healthcare facility. And we already know that African Americans are disproportionately being hit by COVID-19. Tell us what you're seeing.
I'm seeing a hospital that's already not well stocked. So we don't have enough pulse ox machines. Those are machines that just keep track of your heart rate and your oxygen status. I'm seeing not enough Dynamaps on a floor. just not enough equipment. Mm-hmm. And it's now tenfold with COVID-19. And it is incredibly difficult to do a good job. Here in New York, I hear in the city that their patient ratios are higher than what they are typically around the rest of the United States. Most hospitals, it's typically 1 to 4, 1 to 5. They're regular apparently around here is 7. And then you put COVID-19 in and being short-staffed, some floors are having 12 patients to one nurse. You can't do it. These are total care patients. They can't get up and go to the bathroom by themselves. I mean, it's a mess.
Yeah.
It's a mess.
I'm sure, you know, you always have had respect for fellow nurses, but it's probably been heightened now seeing what these nurses that you're joining are going through. We see pictures of people on gurneys in the halls. I mean, what are you seeing?
Yes, the hospital is run out of beds. So a lot of patients are on stretchers. And it's heartbreaking because they're on these stretchers for days at a time. There's no beds to put them on. It's a lot.
Oh, do you need a moment?
No, it just, you watch the news and they tell you it's just a whole lot different when you have to experience it. And then there's not enough people. There's not enough people to help. And then you hear that there's all these people who are waiting. I waited, right? I was called to work and then I waited to actually get called to duty. And you get here and it's like, wait a minute. We need more people. We need more help. We need help.
Do you think, Jessica Schneider, that people are dying because there's not enough people to help them?
I don't know officially if that makes a difference at the end of the day. Do I think that the level of care is changed because of it? Greatly. We as nurses are trained for nursing excellence. And I am not delivering nursing excellence. I am getting by.
Who are you seeing on these stretchers? Is it older people? Do you have time to even? Obviously, you're saying you can't do the nursing that you want, but can you at least make someone comfortable?
As best as I can. And I will say this, that 99% of these patients here are incredibly thankful and lovely. They're just lovely human beings who are so appreciative. So makes it worth it at the end of the day.
Jessica, what would you say to people back in Boise, Idaho? Your governor there issued a stay-at-home order. You know, Idaho doesn't have a huge amount of cases, but more per capita than California because so few people.
Yeah, Blaine County, which is where Sun Valley is, right?
Right.
So super famous people live there. Very, very different than Harlem. Stay home. Everybody stay home. Wash your hands. Social distance. This is not anything I thought I'd ever see in my lifetime, and I sure as heck don't ever want to see it again.
Well, and you have people in your state. I don't want you to wade into the politics of this, but you know very well you've got lawmakers, Republican State Rep Heather Scott and Blanchard, who referred to the governor's mandate as unconstitutional, un-American, not the Idaho way. You're laughing. You know, you've got your Bonner County Sheriff Darrell Wheeler, who said, release us to go on with our normal business. You know that there's pushback. People holding church services.
You know, I listened to a podcast and I thought it was really interesting because they were talking about the adjectives that we use for this and that saying at war and all of this maybe isn't the right adjectives to be using. And a better one is education. You're not educated well about the situation when you look at it that way. That doesn't mean that you're not intelligent. I'm just saying that for some people, if you don't experience it and it's not in your backyard, then you can have a really high opinion. At a time like this, you have to be told what to do because if it happens in your backyard, you're going to be utterly devastated because it's not just going to happen to you. It's going to happen to many, many people that you know, love, and care about. And one minute they will be fine and the next minute they will be dying and nobody wants to go through that.
And Jessica Schneider is in New York, not back in Boise. And it sounds like, as the governor said, people in Boise, do you want New Yorkers to come and help you, which, you know, may have to happen. I guess, Jessica Schneider, you've been terrific in bringing us into this hospital in Harlem. Can you just tick through some of the things you're seeing, maybe faces that have stayed with you, memories you're going to take back with you to Boise?
Oh, yeah. We've got nurses from all over the country, nurse practitioners, respiratory therapists. I met a respiratory therapist from Kentucky today. I worked with a nurse practitioner from Oklahoma the last couple of days, nurses from Mobile, Alabama, from Florida, from Spartanburg, South Carolina. It's awesome to see your country come together. Who are not part of the armed forces, right? We are nurses. We are healthcare workers. We are so proud to come and to help. And I love how thankful to all of the staff here at Harlem are. And they've been amazing at doing their best to try and help us figure out where stuff are, know what codes we need to know to open up doors. It's all hands on deck. All hands on deck.
Yeah.
Can I just say, it's been really hard here at Harlem. This is a very old hospital, 4 and 5 people stuffed in rooms. I've never seen a hospital like this before. I've only ever worked in hospitals that have, you know, private rooms and all that sort of stuff. And there's something about people who don't have a whole lot. They're willing to give everything that they've got. I had a granddaughter today who dropped off coffee and hot chocolate and 2 dozen donuts for the floor from Dunkin' Donuts. And, you know, she can't come up to the floor to see her family, but it's huge because, you know, at the end of the day, I don't know how much money that they have, but they're always so willing to give. And it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
That's Jessica Schneider, who drove from Boise, Idaho, to New York City after Governor Cuomo asked health workers for help. She now works at New York City Health Harlem. Jessica, thank you, thank you, thank you, and thank you for your work.
Thanks so much.
Here at Harlem, we are. The voice of a young woman from Boise, Idaho. We are.
President Trump promised that a new task force dedicated to reopening the economy would begin work this week. The president has also talked about May 1st as a target date, something many health officials say may be too soon. Well, Derek Thompson has been looking at some of the technologies that may allow us to safely reopen the country and prevent a second outbreak. Derek is senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us from Washington, as he does each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
So you write that our best hope to contain this virus once things start reopening is what's known as test and trace. Remind us what that is, and is the U.S. doing it now?
So test and trace is an old idea in public health. Let's break it down into two. Test, most people know what that means. When it comes to COVID, it means that long nasal swab that goes up your nose, and then it's tested with a kit and determines whether or not you have the disease. Trace, it can be a little bit more complicated. Historically, trace has simply meant an old technology, which is interviews. When the CDC was helping to crack down on Ebola in Africa, they would essentially isolate someone who had recently tested positive for Ebola. They'd say, tell me all the people you've come into contact with over the last few days. And then they would go to those friends and family members and businesses and say, hey, we need to talk to you about whether or not you might have the symptoms of Ebola. There's another way, though, that you can do this, which is through cell phone technology. Two technologies that could prove useful here. One is GPS technology, which obviously just says where we are in the world. And then there's Bluetooth, which is used right now in Singapore, where essentially if lots of people download a Bluetooth app, they're going around the world, they're pinging each other as they're passing by or having lunch with each other, you know, going to Starbucks. And then if someone gets sick, they can essentially upload all of their local contacts to some central authority that can essentially review them the same way they would review an interviewed list of contacts and say, all right, these are the new people that we have to reach out to.
But just culturally, I can imagine that working in Singapore, I can imagine that working in China, certainly, but in the United States, you would think there would be some pretty big privacy concerns.
Yes, huge privacy concerns, I think, especially with these cell phone tracing technologies. Now, in South Korea, the tracing technology sort of combines cell phone location data, credit card records. It really broadly monitors citizens' activities so that when an individual tests positive, the local government will essentially send out an alert, kind of like a flood warning, that includes the individual's last name, their sex, age, district of residence, credit card history, maybe even a minute-to-minute record of their comings and goings from various local businesses. I mean, it's incredibly invasive. And one of the worries from privacy experts in the West and certainly in the U.S. is if this is what tracing looks like, you know, if I test positive and everyone in Washington, D.C. gets a text that basically gives away my entire life, well, might that make me less likely to want to get tested?
Now, you spoke with a computer scientist at MIT who is working on an app to map the movements of people who have COVID-19. What did he tell you?
Yeah, Ramesh Raskar is a computer scientist at the MIT Media Lab, and he's working on an app. It relies more on GPS technology than on Bluetooth technology, and the idea is that if someone tested positive, other people on the app could open the app and look at hotspots where people who had tested positive had been recently. And I think a lot of privacy advocates would be horrified. But again, I think the argument from people who are advocates of the technology is we have to weigh privacy against public health. Right now, Americans are under house arrest. That's not a lot of freedom. So if we can constrict people's freedom on this app, maybe we can give them more freedom in exchange because they would be allowed to leave their apartments, houses, and condos.
NPR reported today that there has been little to no progress by the Trump administration on a number of things that could help speed up testing for this virus, including a Google website that was promised and was supposed to help with screening and testing that was never developed. Companies like CVS, Walmart, and Walgreens have not opened up widespread drive-through testing sites as the administration promised. Can any of the things you're talking about happen if the administration doesn't take real steps toward the testing that will be necessary to start this test and trace process?
Two extremely important points. First, none of this is possible without a dramatic ramp up in testing, because without testing, you have no idea who to start tracing. The second important thing, though, is that even if the federal government itself doesn't come up with a national contact tracing scheme, you already have a lot of states around the country who either have small tracing apparatuses set up or who are now hiring hundreds, even thousands of people to start calling people who test positive for COVID to trace their contacts. You also have this big news about Google and Apple coming up with possible tracing features in a new OS update. There's a lot of people working on this problem, not just the federal government, but I also think that that isn't an excuse for the federal government to do nothing. We need a lot more guidance and a lot more clarity from the feds, I think, about when testing is going to ramp up and then how tracing can interact with testing in order to make us truly safe and to allow us to leave our apartments and houses.
That is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.